What did you just do? Oh, spilled. Yeah, oh, yeah, huge mess you made there.
Could have gone the other way. It could have gone all over the deck.
That's why we...
And there's like our first year of patronage gone on a new deck that was not in the fucking budget.
The cup of tea of doom.
The cup of tea of fucking doom. Christ. Don't get... You just say, oh, well, the patrons can pay for that. Getting cocky.
I wake up in the morning and I roll out of bed and I have cereal and there's no cereal in the box. And I go,
well, the patrons can pay.
And Jules goes, what are you fucking talking about? I go, don't worry, the patrons, they'll pay for it. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. My name is Ian Mond. I'm here in sunny Wendery.
You're an idiot.
So the podcast for, I think, the third time this year, it feels like the third time this year, it may actually be the second time, has moved.
We have a new home. In yes. My home. Yay.
Yeah, which is the better place for it because, as you pointed out, it's on a table.
It is on a table, an actual table at table height.
Yeah, which does mean there'll be no more featuring the Mon children. They will no longer be on the podcast. So
that's okay. It also means all that background noise is gone.
It wasn't that bad.
You don't even listen to them.
No.
So how do you know?
Was it that bad?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, after the podcast, I would, you know, scream at my kids and lock them in their room and say, you're not allowed out until you apologise to Kirsten for making background noise on the podcast.
I never got an apology.
Yeah, I know.
If they told you they did, they didn't.
No, well, okay. They are only young.
Yeah.
So anyway, we are now, so we're in Kirsten's house. So it's a very, and it was a lovely drive. It's 100, I just, so the listeners know, so they get the, you
skip
know.
Skip to the end.
No. So the listeners knows for me, it's a 130-kilometre journey. What's 130 kilometres in miles for our...
It's roughly double.
It's 2.25, isn't it? All right, it's about 250 miles.
I did say roughly. When you get a recipe that says, like, roughly chopped carrots, do you get out your T-square and your... Hey, slide
for,
rule.
Apparently for baking you do have to do that, all right? So anyway.
God, why are we talking? You're the one who's going to get out of here. Go.
It's a new environment and so, you know, I'm excited and passionate because, you know, this is a really beautiful house that you've got.
Thank you.
Yeah, we should take photos of it.
No.
Okay. So what are we going to talk about first? Well, given that this is... Given that this episode
I shouldn't
is
have
the,
let you run this one, clearly.
Given this episode is the Aurealis winner of two categories episode, because we're not doing all the winners.
No.
Mostly because, God, you say that like, fuck the other winners.
No, it would just take a long time.
Well, yeah, and also we did review.
There are a lot of winners.
We did review one of the winners, which won twice, the Trent Jemison book.
Yes.
So, you know, to be fair.
Dayboy.
Hey, Clay didn't get up, did it? No.
No.
No, that was Illuminae.
Yes.
Okay. So we thought we'd start by discussing the elephant in the room with regards to this year's Aurealis Awards before we got on to the actual winning books, which was the horror.
Novel.
Best horror novel shortlist, which didn't exist. Now, this is something close to our hearts because Kirsten and I met for the first time at the, what was it called back then?
The Australian Horror Society.
Was you sure that was the name?
The AHS, okay. I am sure.
All right. And that's where we first met many years ago.
It was.
We apparently... I was known as Ian, not Mondy, even though I've been known as Mondy since I was, like, out of the womb.
You introduced yourself as Ian.
Well, that's because I'm...
Ian to this day.
Okay, it's true.
And people think I'm weird because you're Mondy.
That's right.
But I'm very proper about names.
You are. So, that's where we met. So horror is, you know, we're invested in the old horror.
We are.
And Australia does produce strong horror work.
Yes, that doesn't, in small quantities.
In small quantities, but enough to make up a shortlist every year.
Usually.
Well, you were the previous year where there was issues with the horror novel list.
No, I wasn't. No, it's about 3 years ago that was.
Yeah, that weren't you the judge? I'm saying you. I said you were on the year, not it was last.
Oh, yes.
You were on the year.
Yeah, no. When I judged it 2 or 3 years ago, can't quite remember. We didn't come up with a winner because it was a. I think there were like 8 entries. It was a very light year, and we just decided that none of the entries were actually worthy of giving an Aurealis Award to. That said, we did have 2 honourable mentions because we thought there were 2 books that, while for various reasons you can go read our judges' report, I'm sure it's still on the site somewhere, we thought they weren't quite award-worthy, but they were still of note. And that's really what shortlists – and, I mean, the awards in total are about. They're about they're there for posterity.
So you went to the awards ceremony.
Yeah.
Did you get an explanation as to why there was no shortlist for horror that you can talk about?
It's in the judges' report, so I can read to you what the explanation is, actually. Okay. It's public. It's in the Aurealis book, okay, which is downloadable from their website. So it's no like state secrets here. So I can just read out to you what the judging criteria and
before,
the overview.
Before you do, yep, should we actually explain what the Aurealis Awards is?
For those who don't know, so the Aurealis Awards are, I guess, the premier genre awards in Australia and have been for many years.
That are juried rather than fan.
They are a juried award, yes. So they're different to, I guess, the other most well-known award in specfic, which would be the DITMARs, and they are fan-nominated and fan-voted on like the Hugos.
Yep.
Except we don't, as yet, have any puppies to worry about with the DITMARs, but anyway. Or maybe they'll move to us if Hugo changes their rules.
No, you can log roll the DITMARs in with only six people in a room. Anyway.
Sadly, that's true. But the Aurealis Awards are a juried award. So there is a panel of these days usually four or five people who are the judges, and they read everything that is submitted to the awards, and they confer within a panel, not between panels, obviously, and decide on the shortlist and the winners.
Now, one thing to be made clear, they read what is submitted, although they themselves can go out and find
anyone
stuff.
Can submit anything to the Aurealis Awards.
Including the judges themselves.
Including the judges themselves.
Plus, if a book
and
is,
I have done when I have come across books. So, when
and
I'm
also,
judged.
If a book like The Skin of a Monster, the book that we're going to, one of the books mm-hmm. we're going to discuss, is only marked for young adult, not horror, mm-hmm. which I think you could have gone under horror.
Yeah, it could have.
If it's only marked by the publisher as young adult and the horror judges weren't aware of the book, then it won't get picked up for a horror.
It's the awareness. That's the factor okay. because you can't – well, anyone can nominate because – I mean, readers can nominate. Anyone can nominate. It's free. So if you, Ian, come across a novel and you think it should be considered for an Aurealis Award, you can go to the Aurealis website and you can nominate it and say there's this horror novel that I think should be considered. And then the Aurealis coordinators will contact the author and or publisher and say, hey, your book's been nominated. Would you – please send a copy to the judges. And I think with novels, there's now a $5 fee to enter your novel. With short stories and novellas, it's still free. But yeah, so basically anyone can nominate, but it is up to the author and or the publisher to physically submit a copy of their work, either in electronic or hard copy form, because the judges have to get a copy and the onus should not be on the judges to actually purchase the copies of the books that they're needing to judge. But yeah, anyone can actually nominate, and as has happened in the past, judges have nominated works that they've come across that haven't been. And Aurealis is completely transparent. So they every year they publish an ongoing list of everything that has been submitted.
Absolutely transparent. There are no secrets here.
So if there's a book that you think, oh, that really should have been on the shortlist, you can go and look and see if it was. It might not have even been submitted. So as the example you gave in The Skin of a Monster, which could have been considered a horror book, it wasn't entered into the horror category, and the horror judges obviously weren't aware of it, and that's fine because it's marketing wise it's not marketed as a horror novel, so you can't be expected to know every book that's published in Australia every year.
I'm not having a crack at them. I'm just saying that there will be things that slip through the cracks.
So that's the way.
Okay, read the judges' report.
The awards work. So for horror novel this year, the judging criteria was that a work in the horror category, and I should preface this by saying that the judges form their own criteria, so this is not given to them by the Aurealis people. Every judging committee gets together and works out what they're looking for and makes a...
And a shout-out to Tahani, who does a great job, by the way.
Oh, yes, Tahani, who's the judging coordinator. And also Catherine Stubbs, who's doing also working with the judging, coordinating and wrangling and everything. So, yes, they... Thankless job in many ways, but we thank them. So the judging criteria for the best horror novel is work in the horror category should be intended to disturb or inspire fear, dread or trepidation in the reader. Stories may include psychological suspense, occult fiction, dark fiction and paranormal fiction. A work need not contain supernatural elements to be considered horror. Literary merit is of paramount importance. So that's the criteria on which they were.
That was good until that last hint, I have a funny feeling, is going to come back. Yeah, anyway.
And so then, as we know, there was no shortlist. Trent Jamison's book, Day Boy, did win the award, much to, I guess, everybody's surprise.
Why?
Because there's no shortlist.
Oh, surprise. Not surprises in how the fuck did he win the award, but surprises in there was no shortlist, so they didn't know who could have won. It could have been anyone.
Right.
It could have been me.
But Trent was there because he was nominated for...
And had already won an award by that stage.
Yeah, he won the YA novel. Okay. But he was also nominated for science fiction, so he had two speeches prepared anyway. So he was there. So when he won Aura, he used one of his speeches.
So he was a complete surprise.
But yeah, it's a complete surprise because... You know, there was no shortlist, so there was no like, oh, which one's going to win? So what they said about the overview of the nominations and I guess why they didn't have a shortlist. While there were 13 novels submitted, none of them spoke equally to all the judges, so it was decided that no shortlist would be released. Some of the novels entered had a great story premise or were disturbing and chilling or had great characters or lyrical prose, were well-structured or had other strengths. But the winner was a standout, especially with regards to style, story structure and compelling writing working as a cohesive whole.
I'm sorry.
I've got to say.
If they unanimously.
If
they unanimously turned around and said, yeah, this is a shit bunch of 13 novels, except for the winner, clearly, but the other 12 are rank, and they all said, yeah, this is just crap.
Yeah, it's...
You sort of could make an argument, but when it's a group of judges who can't agree, that happens in every single juried world fantasy Shirley Jackson, just speak to the people who have been on those awards and you'll always find compromise.
Yeah. Look, I will say that, I mean, you know, Ian, when the... When the Aurealis shortlist came out and there was no horror shortlist.
You weren't that happy.
I was really not that happy. And it's like, well, I'll wait to the awards and the judges report and let's see what, you know, because, you know, I... Because I went to the awards and so I sat down and you get the booklets there on the table because none of the winners are in it. It's just the shortlist and the report. So there's nothing given away. So everyone gets the book to start with. And I went straight to the horror category and read that. And I got even angrier.
Because of this idea.
I had calmed down and then I read that and say, what? Not unanimous. That's it. You couldn't all agree on a... You know what? You got four judges. You got four shortlist slots. Everyone picks their book. That's a shortlist.
Correct.
If you really can't agree, that's how you make
shortlist. And that's exactly... There's at least one book that they all agree on. There's a plus.
So there's one. And I did talk to Tahani and she said there's no... Oh, sorry, there is. Aurealis requires a minimum of three on a shortlist simply because they don't want a winner and a loser.
Yeah. No, that's
which
fair.
Is fair, right?
Fair. So I have no problem with that.
You do need to come up with three titles, but only three.
Yeah. So
it's not like they needed to come up with five out of the 13.
Correct.
They only needed two more apart from Trent's. And I did check. And, you know, not to, like, stay on my, you know, soapbox, but Lament for the Afterlife was entered into the horror novel category, so they read that.
And yes,
and honestly, I can't see why.
But people will say, "Well, that's a matter of taste, Kirsten." I mean, we loved it clearly.
No, and I'm going to stop you there, Ian, because you've just made me angry. Judging an award is not a matter of taste.
Ooh, okay, what is it then?
Personal taste should not come into it, and as a judge, you should be able to recognise the qualities of a book even if it is not to your personal taste in reading. That is part of your job. The juried awards, they're not the Ditmars or the Hugos, they're not my favourite book, the book I just loved. You need to bring critical faculties to assessing work. You need to put it in context of the genre and the history of the genre and what the genre is doing now and where it may go in the future. You need to be able to assess a book on its critical merit without going, "Oh, but this is just my favourite book."
Don't you need to be passionate about books on your list?
Sure, but you need to be able to recognise that other books that may not be to your reading taste are significant works.
Partly agree with you, but I do have this concern. Putting aside the fact that we actually furiously agree there should have been a shortlist, right?
Yes, we furiously agree.
I do not think there is a set of objective categories.
There is not objective categories.
It does still come back to, even if it's not a I accept that a matter of taste is not a good enough argument.
Yeah.
There's still a bunch of subjective responses to a work.
Of course there is.
Okay. And
but this is why you have a panel.
Yeah. No,
this is
okay,
not one person because it is – Like, I'm not saying it's an easy thing. It is, you know, divorcing.
And Limit for the Afterlife, which absolutely should have been on a shortlist. Is a difficult, challenging novel.
It is.
And it is not to everyone's taste.
I think that's what you need to recognize.
People will read that book and some people will bounce off it because of the nature of the novel. But it is absolutely an extraordinary work.
And it's a significant work. It's a significant work in the genre. It's a significant
And you're not
going to
mention Jason because he's your husband.
No.
But same deal. Should have been on the fucking shortlist. I mean, this is where...
The point is, to make a shortlist this year for horror, apart from the winner, you only needed two other works.
Correct.
And the point of a shortlist, as I was sort of alluding to earlier, it's not just to say, oh, we're the judges and these are our favourite books this year. You are continuing a history that for the Aurealis is more than 20 years old now.
Yes.
You are providing notes for the future for people who look back and look at works that were significant. And if you do not provide a shortlist when you have a winner, and as I said, the year we didn't have a winner, I've no real problems with not having winners, obviously, because sometimes they're not there. And in the way that you are helping to curate the history of the genre in this country, sometimes you do say none of the works this year are up to that level where we want to say they're award.
Okay, there's a difference between saying writers do better.
Yeah.
This is good, but do better if you want to get an award versus blank.
Yeah.
We've got a winner, but blank essentially.
What blank says is apart from this one book, there's nothing worth even mentioning this year.
That is what it says.
So in the future, you don't even have to worry
and
about 2015.
And I know the judges would argue, but yes, we
read
all had
Day
our...
Boy, that's it. Everything else, not even worth a mention. Because the shortlist is the mention.
Correct.
That's it. And it's not like a...
But the judges would jump in and say, no, we did love... Judge One says, I did love Lament for the Afterlife.
Then put it on the shortlist.
No, but the two others didn't.
Doesn't matter.
It's not a democracy.
If you have a panel which is that fractious and cannot unanimously agree, the simplest thing, as I said, is all right, fine, everyone gets a slot. And unless every single one of the judges only liked Day Boy, which I think is a travesty.
But then that's what they should have written there.
Yeah.
Was there only one winner of the other 12 books, they just were not good enough.
Yes.
They haven't written that.
No, they didn't.
They've implied that, there were favourites, but
they
we just
implied that they couldn't agree on a shortlist, which I think is. I don't know the judges this year, but I think that's just a huge cop-out. Because it's a big responsibility. I think judging an award like this is a big responsibility because you are, as I said, you are curating history. It's wonderful to be nominated for these awards and to win the awards. And obviously, it's wonderful. But that's one part of what the award does is recognise writers currently and give them an award because, the jury's out on whether awards have much significance unless you're up at, like, Man Booker level, whether awards do actually much for the career of authors immediately.
But it's a history, as you
but
were
it
saying.
It is history. You are helping to curate.
People will look
curate the history of the genre.
People have done with the Hugos and every other fucking award night to me, and they look back to the past.
You know, and as I said, when you don't provide a shortlist, when you have a winner and you don't provide a shortlist, that says there was only one book worth even mentioning this year. And that, I think that's just patently wrong as of last year.
What about the argument that, okay, we've recognised one book, but actually, as we said before, it's transparent as to what was actually nominated, what was put forward for horror. So if you want to look at a reading list.
No, that's not there forever. The entire spreadsheet of every book that was submitted every year is not there forever.
Sure?
Yeah, pretty sure. They're not going to keep a whole bunch of spreadsheets up on their website forever. No one, and it's only on the Aurealis site. No one else is keeping them around. I mean, you can find awards, shortlists, and nominations everywhere. You don't just have to go to the awards site to find them. People spread them around. Yeah. They get disseminated. Another issue, which wasn't the judge's fault, but this year with because there was no shortlist in the horror novel, I wrote to Locus and asked them to correct it, but I know the Locus page where they mentioned the awards and it's another page, another website where they mentioned the Aurealis Awards, didn't even mention there was a horror novel winner. because what they'd done was just update their post. Yeah. And because there was no shortlist and Horror had nothing in it, they didn't even go back and see that there was a winner. So,
that's the other issue.
And so when for 24 hours, when Locust came out and everyone's reblogging it and redoing it, you can't go and catch everyone.
Yeah.
But I emailed Locust and they changed it pretty quickly to their credit. But yeah, so... So what exposure Trent would have had for Dayboy. Fortunately, he also won the YA award, so that novel was on the Aurealis list.
All right. Before I want to end this.
But yeah, but I mean that's kind of the issue. So I think
I want to end this, but yeah. I want to ask you this question though.
Mm.
Why does this always seem to happen to horror?
Because horror is apart from the glory days of the 90s.
Because I just,
horror is
a
notoriously difficult genre to
because
publish in
go
Australia.
Go to the Bram Stokers.
In Australia.
No, in Australia. But no, but go back to the Bram Stoker, yep. Which is not Australia.
Mm-hmm.
That shortlist for the novel shortlist, and you were on the judging panel for that too.
I judged the Stokers a few years ago, yep.
It also gets pounded for the stuff that gets on those nomination lists. And
I'm not going to talk about the Stokers.
Okay. Well, you just have. Why not? But I don't know. Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe the heyday has come. There was meant to be a resurgence.
You can
could have come up with a shortlist.
The thing is, you can argue what goes onto a shortlist till the cows literally come home.
Have a fucking shortlist.
Right? I mean, and people will all the time. Yeah. Oh, that shouldn't have won. Oh, why didn't this get on the shortlist? And you can do that. And that is when the judges' preferences and critical opinions come into play. And as you say, there is a large amount of subjectivity there. But if there's no shortlist at all, and it's kind of open season because it's like any good book, surely that's on the shortlist. No. Oh, okay. Well, it made me very sad and a little cross because I just think
it was wrong.
A dereliction of duty.
You were fucking furious. Don't diminish it. No, and rightly so. You were fucking furious.
I think it was a dereliction of duty on the part of the judging panel. I really do because they had a winner. And out of the 12 other books, surely
two of those
are worth mentioning. Because it's not like it's a popular award. It's not like the judges, as with the Stokers, where the
it's 50-50, isn't it?
It's the judges compile 50% of the long list, and the other 50% of the long list is compiled by the members of the Horror Writers Association. Yep. But then the winner is decided by the members, so it's a voted. So as a judge, and I'm not speaking for the judges, but I'm saying as a judge of the Stokers, you don't get to decide the winner. What you get to do is put books forward onto ultimately a shortlist for the membership of the HWA to vote. So it's a hybrid kind of award in that way. So you get some judged opinions and then you get some popular opinions and then the popular vote decides the winner. But the Aurealis doesn't work like that. It's not like the judges here would have put books on a shortlist and gone, oh, God, but I really don't want it to win the award. If I put it on the shortlist, maybe people will vote for it. No, you decide on the winner. The shortlist isn't a ballot. There's no danger of a book that you don't think should actually win the award winning the award.
Okay. I have one final question. What is the role of the conveners, the coordinators of the Aurealis Awards? This is controversial. To say to a group like that and say, fucking come up with a shortlist.
I don't know. I don't know whether they're able to do that or not. I don't know.
Okay.
But if you're asking just like hypothetically, should they have a – I think they probably should. I think this judging panel should have been told to go and sit in a corner until they'd come up with something. But, you know, I also understand that, again, everything is kind of volunteerish and you don't want to get too fractious because you're asking people to come and do stuff. So,
yeah, no one's being paid for it.
So it's really – so it is difficult because you're not employing someone and you can just say, you're not doing your job, you're fired, because there's no job and no one's getting paid. But, yeah, in terms of this panel in particular, I think to say that we just couldn't unanimously decide on a shortlist is a little bit of bullshit.
A little bit of bullshit. That's the way it went.
It's a bad, bad, bad reason. As you say, the only reason I kind of, I guess, would have been happy, still very sad about, but happy with, would have been if, as you'd said, the report was all the other 12 books were shit.
Were rank.
But I've read some of those other 12 books, and they're not.
There's a Gary Kemble in there, isn't there?
I've not read Gary Kemble's, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
This is the thing. It's... Now everything's open, right? Because there's no shortlist. We're not arguing about books that we've read that weren't on the shortlist and other books were, and why were they better? And because there is nothing. This is the problem. There is nothing. There is no. There's like this lacuna in the history of horror in 2015 that says one book and one book only is worth remembering.
Well, I just hope the judges of 2016, sad. Whomever they may be, do a better job. Okay, so.
Anyway, so yes. Let's,
talking about the Aurealis Awards, we're going to talk about two of the winners.
We are, because there were winners.
So I am bad, a person.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, in a
what
sense
way
that, because the first book we're going to speak about is The Skin In The Skin Of A Monster by Catherine Barker, and I'm bad in that it won the Best Young Adult Novel jointly.
Yes.
So we run jointly with Trent Jameson's Day Book.
Yes, and we've already read Day Boy. Yes. So.
A Day Boy, I suppose it's a Day Book. Day Boy.
Yes, but we've already, as listeners will have known, we've already talked about Day Boy at length. So if you haven't heard that one, you can go back and look up Day Boy on the website and you can go back and hear what we thought about Day Boy, which jointly won with this one. Yes. So we're going to talk about this one today.
We like Day Boy.
Did like Day Boy.
Yes.
Did you like Day Boy better than In the Skin of a Monster?
Yes.
Me too.
I wouldn't have had I personally would not have had a joint winner.
No. And that's okay. Winners, shortlists, as long as there is one. Yes. They are fodder to debate about.
Yeah.
But you never kind
I don't
of
think
view.
In the Skin of the Monster is an awful book, but I have massive issues with it.
Yeah, I didn't love it. I liked it, and there was a lot I liked about it, but I did not love it, and have some issues.
I love it when you say that. I did not love it.
Because the second one, spoilers, I love.
Yeah, we both did. Yeah, the Meg McKinley, which we'll get to. So, yeah. Catherine Barker's In the Skin of a Monster. You've got it there. You want to read the back of the blurb, back cover, or?
Yes, you're right. I'll read the blurb because it is interesting. 3 years ago, Alice's identical twin sister took a gun to school and killed 7 innocent kids. Now Alice wears the face of a monster. It's a small town and no one can stand to even look at her. But when Alice encounters her sister on a deserted highway, bad is just the beginning. Alice soon finds herself trapped in a dangerous new reality, a broken world that's filled with the nightmares of everyone in the community. Here, with old secrets finally coming together, Alice is forced to confront the true impact of everything that happened that day in the schoolyard, including her hidden connection to the boy who hates her most. Which I think, that's a pretty good summation of the book, actually.
It is.
As an intro premise to the book.
Yeah, and I think the concept of you being the twin of a girl who went off and shot a whole bunch of people, and therefore the guilt. It's not just the guilt that you feel, but the town applying that hatred onto you, an innocent victim.
It's that much easier to project, isn't it, when you look almost exactly like the person who killed their children.
That is fantastic as a concept.
And I didn't actually realise it was going to be as spec-ficky as it is.
I just wish it hadn't been as spec-ficky.
Because it's like it's bang, like from chapter 2 or something, you're there in the nightmare world, which is this alternate world that, as the blurb suggested, is peopled by creations from people's nightmares.
I'll say this now because I don't want it, because they say don't critique a book for not being the thing you wanted it to be.
Yes.
So I'll say this now, I would have actually rather this not have had any spec fic in it at all and actually been about a look at what it is to have the same face as a killer. And not had all the MacGuffin-y nightmare shit and dream world
except
stuff.
Except that I guess the book was using all that.
Yes, to work through those issues.
To
but
work
I,
through
but,
what it was
But
like.
A mimetic book or a realistic book could have worked through the issues
no, I
as
agree.
Well. And I don't know. Anyway.
And this particular take on it didn't quite work for
it
you.
It didn't gel for me. Yeah. But that's a critique of the book wasn't the book I wanted it to be. And we'll move past that because let's now focus on the book as it is.
Yeah.
So, first off.
Yep.
It's a school shooting.
It is a school shooting.
In New South Wales.
In New South
in
Wales.
In a town that actually exists.
In a town that actually exists. And so the town is called Calexa, which is this little tiny leave the highway off the beaten track little town between Goulburn and Canberra. And I've actually been to Calexa years and years and years ago because the first time my mum and my sisters and I drove past it. It's just like a weird name. It's like Collector. Ooh, that sounds creepy.
And it's famous for in this book, it's famous for a big emu.
A big emu. The actual town of Collector has this weird kind of art statue thing, which is not lovely. And
the council's been wanting to take
council
it down.
Doesn't like it, apparently. No. But anyway, there's no big emu in Collector.
That we're aware of.
I pretty sure there's no big emu in
collector. Plus, the primary school in the real collector has, well, according to Wikipedia, so it might have got bigger, has 28 kids in it.
Oh, so if she collector's killed... a tiny town. No, and no, even, no, but even in this novel, collector's a tiny town. But, it's 800 and something people.
Yeah, but it's the school in collector, though, isn't it?
Or is it is.
So if she killed seven people in the real collector, she'd have wiped out a quarter of the school.
Well, I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
And it's only a primary school in the actual real collector. From what I read on Wikipedia, it's not a secondary school.
Yeah, because it's a tiny little town. It wouldn't support a high school. But I guess you could say, well, this school is one of those – because there was also a nine-year-old killed at the school.
Yes.
So you could say that the school's not a high school. The school is like – it's an all-grade school because there's only like 30 kids or something.
The question comes back to why base it in a real place.
That actually kind of perplexed me throughout the whole book because it is – now, she's taken liberties with the town by – I guess making the big emu one of the key points of it, which doesn't exist. As I said to Ian, I'm not an expert, but I am an aficionado of an enthusiast of the big things that Australia has to offer.
Like the big orange, or is it the big wombat? Or there's big shit.
There's
everywhere.
Big shit everywhere.
Big bananas, definitely big banana.
Big banana in Coffs Harbour. Yeah. There's a big worm down in Victoria, further down the peninsula. I had my doubts about there actually being the big emu and collector, and Google furnished nothing. So I'm assuming there's no big emu and collector. So she has certainly wasn't when I passed through back in the 90s. But no, so she's taken liberties with the town. And I'm actually quite perplexed as to why she chose a real town.
Do you think she didn't know it was real?
I think it would be a massive coincidence to call this little town in rural New South Wales Collector. When there is a real town in rural New South Wales called Collector.
Could you argue that the town isn't Collector, it's just the nightmare world that's Collector?
No, the town is Collector, she says. It's the town is in Collector and the world mirrors it and overlays it.
Okay, all right.
So that was odd. And I did wonder how – I mean, I don't know. For all I know, Catherine Barker grew up in Collector or lives there now. Doesn't mention that in her bio. But I did wonder how the people who actually do live in the very real town of Collector would feel about their little town being turned into – the first school shooting in Australia in like 3 decades.
Well, that's
or something.
My next point. Okay.
It's weird. Like, I don't know why she didn't just make up a fictional town because she changed the town anyway. It's not like there's a massive world famous or Australia famous landmark in Collector that she's used because it's essential to the story. So it just seemed odd to me why you wouldn't just make up a town.
I agree. And that really leads to my second point, which you've hinted at, which is having a school shooting in Australia to begin with is a big deal. Okay. So, I'm not arguing that school shootings in this country, touch wood, et cetera, whatever, can't happen in Australia, all right?
Sure.
But we have pretty strong gun laws in that.
Yeah.
Okay. So
– but people in regional and rural areas have access to guns.
Yeah, I'm not saying they don't.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it
– not semi-automatics, thank goodness.
I'm not saying, though, that it's not – it's a pistol, though, in this, isn't it? It's not a rifle. It's a – handgun.
Yeah, no, you're right. It is a handgun, so they are harder to come by.
So I'm not saying it can't happen in Australia. Of course it can happen. The last school shooting, and it wasn't really a school, it was a university, was at Monash University in 2000. Do you remember that, 2002?
I do.
Yeah. So that's 14 years ago. The last, obviously, major massacre was the
Port Arthur
massacre. Mm.
But the last time a child picked up a gun
and shot up
and
a
shot
bunch
other
of,
children at school was.
I believe there was one. Oh, look, I did a really quick check on Wikipedia. There was something about New South Wales in the early 90s, 91 or something.
I didn't even, which is weird because I grew up in Newcastle, New South Wales, and I don't even remember. I don't even have the vaguest memory of that.
So it's a 25 year old at best.
Yeah.
Okay. Occurrence. Now, I'm again not saying that can't happen here, but it is clearly an American phenomenon.
For the most part, I guess, yes.
I'll make a broad generalisation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's not to say, I mean, yeah.
But it does, okay, I don't mind it being in the book.
Yeah. But the fact that it's not addressed, that
it's not
really
addressed
unusual.
At all. That what's addressed is the guilt and the hatred and all that sort of stuff. But that it's not addressed at all, that this, if this were to actually happen in a small town in Australia, it would be a seismic shock to the whole country.
But
in the way that I think needs to be addressed in this book.
Yeah. I think it's hard though because that didn't occur to me. I think because the book is told in two first person narratives from two different characters. You have Alice, who's the twin sister of the girl who shut up her school. And then you have a character called Lux who's lives in the nightmare world and comes from the nightmare world. So you have these two first-person narratives. So it is only Alice's perspective, and there is a lot said about how there was a lot of media attention. Like, they made two movies. So it was – I think it was a big deal. I just think for Alice at this point of time in the book, that's not the key thing she's thinking about. But the fact that there were two movies made, one with – some famous American actress who's not named, everywhere. So it was obviously a big deal.
Yeah, but to me that just felt like a bit of a gag. And again, it felt like part of that overall American experience of gun shootings that you would make a movie about it, a TV movie.
You totally would.
A TV week special, a sort of movie.
Oh, I think the idea was that it was a big movie, actually.
Yeah, which had a fame.
And a bit of an exploitation movie.
And a point's made that the actress playing her sister is this beautiful bombshell, look nothing like her sister.
American actress. We do tend to import someone from America to make our movies.
It's more the point that there's such cultural baggage around school shootings and what they mean.
Yeah.
And in Australia, proud is not the word, but we do have some – I mean, every time you hear about these things in America, there's always this article about it. And in Australia, it never happens. Not to say it doesn't and it can't and it –
Might not, but
I don't know. I just felt
I do see what you're saying. I guess it didn't bother me as much because I can see that as being there's enough talked about around what happened in the aftermath of this event in terms of media and people's opinions and all of that sort of stuff that. I can see that Alice, as a teenager, that's not what she's most immediately concerned with. And the book is 3 years later, so I guess it's a bit odd that reflection hasn't come into it when she has reflected on a whole bunch of other stuff. But, you know, that's possibly not – like us in our, you know, like 40s, I guess that's the thing we kind of think about, but maybe – as a kid, when you're literally in the middle of the thing that happened, the bigger cultural implications aren't necessarily.
I suppose
the thing
it's
you
not
go
helped
to.
For me.
So, as a first person narrative, it is hard to bring that in.
It's not helped for me that her sister doing the killing.
Yeah.
I don't see how psychologically she gets from I want to leave Collector because it's
this
boring.
That was my big problem with because the book all the way through the book it does the. It plays the withholding game,
yes.
What I think about as the withholding game,
yes.
Which in a first-person narrative can get, and with this book, for me, did get quite irritating.
Oh, my God. How many times did someone say, if only I told them the deep, dark secret? Lux does it all the time. You know,
Lux does it all the time.
If only is it Ivan, the monster's name? Yeah. If only Ivan knew the real truth
and
about
Alice
me.
Has these secrets, too, that she's constantly going, oh, well, if I'd done this, then I would have realized and so the withholding game has the effect as on a reader by its very virtue of the fact that every so often a character will go, oh, well, there's this secret you don't know. It just builds up the expectation
of
that secret.
It hypes it up, yeah.
So then when the secret is finally revealed, if it doesn't meet the expectations of, in this case, how absolutely awful it has to be, and it's really not. Like, it's not an awful secret, the thing that happened that Alice has blamed herself for.
Here's the point, that with her sister, Alice hasn't noticed predilections to this sort of violence. In fact, it's a surprise to her. In fact, I think even the opening of the book is, while I was dreaming of bubblegums and fairies or whatever.
So you know,
I'm paraphrasing.
Yes.
No, but yeah, no, there, you there were is, thinking of murder yeah. or and action.
I mean, and that's...
But, no.
That's fine.
No, wait a sec.
Because there isn't always signs.
Well, okay, fine. Yes, there's not always signs. But then the reason to set her off has got to be, I don't know, it's got to be something. Even if in the real world people do just pick up guns and shoot other people for reasons that are.
Well, they don't. What that's different. What I'm saying is there isn't always external signs.
Okay.
And we play the game of then backwards reading into things
and
as
part
though.
Of this, and one of the things Barker's doing here, and to her credit, is for Alice, it is the questions, the unanswered questions that you've left us with because we don't know why you did this. And I'm now blaming myself. Because I'm trying to figure it out, so I'm putting the blame on myself because we ignored you. Because the whole thing is, the whole revelation, the big revelation is that on the night – is it the night before?
Oh, it's like
or
a couple of nights before, I think.
The sister, who I don't know if she's actually named. We think her name's – well, Kel is the name of the nightmare version of the sister.
Which doesn't end up being a version of her anyway. It's correct. A version of Alice.
So maybe she is named. If she is, it's done so rarely that neither of us can remember her name. So anyway, we'll call it the sister for the sake of this discussion.
Because I will say that the first-person narrative of Alice is partially written in the second person because her narrative is written to her sister.
Yes.
So she says a lot of stuff like you and you and you, and that's not to the reader, that's to her sister.
The big reveal.
So there may not
is a few nights before, Alice, and I'm going to call her Kel for the sake of this.
Kel's, it's not Kel.
I know.
Her sister. Just
her sister's boyfriend.
Yep.
Meeting at their secret place, and they don't, neither Alice nor the boyfriend believe the sister when she says, I want out of here. Can you, let's go now, essentially. I've packed a bag. Let's piss off. Collector's boring, dull as shit. Let's go.
And if we don't go, I'm going to shoot someone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And she says, if we don't go, I'll kill someone.
Because this is the sort of stuff that her sister kind of said.
Yes. And frankly, I probably
think it was a joke too.
Unless you knew she had violent predilections and unless you saw evidence of that prior. Yeah. Not that she'd shot people, but.
But I mean, it's fine. It's fine that
but
you.
But that's the reveal, though.
That's the reveal. And that is also the reason why, like, the reason why she. We don't know the reason why. But yeah, as you say, psychologically, through the book.
And the way that ends up is that you sort of feel that the sister, not being listened to, said, well, I said I was going to kill people. I'll just fucking kill them then. And goes to school with a gun and shoots seven people, one of them being her boyfriend.
Yeah.
In a sort of a bizarre revenge, you didn't take me seriously, so I'm now going to punish you by shooting you away.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Which I just did not make any.
It is because, the implications.
It's the game you're talking about that you've hyped it up so much that there's got to be. And you said, I think off. You said before.
Oh, because
you're hoping
when you're reading a book that plays a withholding game, it automatically makes you start to wonder what's being withheld. And I thought, oh, don't tell me like it's going to be that there was a teacher at her school who was molesting her or molesting someone else or maybe molesting Alice and Alice hasn't told us that. And so this was a revenge thing. But no, it wasn't any of that. The idea is that the sisters had these horrible nightmares her whole life. And this is part of. She has contributed to creating what's in the nightmare world, but she hasn't made the nightmare world. It's everyone's dreams and nightmares that does that.
It's a Jungian sort of.
Yeah. In fact, it's become a nightmare world because after the shooting, everyone in Collectors started having heaps and heaps of nightmares. I get the impression it's actually just kind of a dream world.
Yeah, it is.
It got really bad because everyone started having all these nightmares and peopling the world with monsters and versions of the sister who killed everyone. But it's not necessarily a nightmare world generally. But the idea is that she had these horrendous nightmares kind of her whole life, and that maybe drove her to. I said the psychology of it doesn't quite gel for me like it didn't gel for you. And I just thought that's just a bit too. Yeah,
I got annoyed that it is set in a dream world because I think more work needed to be done on. On the psychology of what's going on in our world more than the story about Lux, who frankly I didn't give a crap about.
No.
Because Lux is also withholding the truth about himself.
Yes.
He's an angel, sort of. He's an image of an angel. Because he's the drawing, because the sister has scribble books where she draws pictures of angels.
From her nightmares. Draws her nightmares.
And Lux is an
trying to get them out of her system.
And Lux is a.
One of the
instantiation of that.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
And that's his secret, basically.
That's his secret. That she created him, which doesn't seem like a massive secret to.
I suppose in the context of the dream world where you don't want to admit what. Given Lux's job with Ivan, the monster, is to go around killing the. Because this schoolgirl. The schoolgirl, the evil schoolgirl, pops up in our. She's now a zombie everywhere in this nightmare world. And so Lux and Ivan are off killing every version of her.
But the problem is.
So I suppose if you're killing the thing that created you, that would be something you probably wouldn't go tell everyone. But it just, whatever.
Ivan, but then there's a part in the book where Ivan seems to have known that.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, there's a whole prophecy thing.
Yeah, so it's like, it's just weird it wouldn't have come up before now. But. But anyway, but the other thing I was like looking at the structure of the book and the way it's written and the choices in point of view and so on, because Lux's narrative is told in first person but in present tense, and so he's just kind of there stuck in the moment. He can't have any exterior perspective or perspective from down the track, because he's all in the present tense. And I like that. I like that the guy in the dream world is just about the now. That was really clever. But yeah, it doesn't, you know, and his story, I guess, is just, he's just telling his story as he goes through the book.
But what is his purpose in the book? What does he? He's not a victim.
To be the one who gives the perspective of the dream world, I guess. But the thing is, with Alice's book, you find out at the very end, she's written her story down. So hers is a written, and it's,
yes,
in the past tense.
Yes.
And it's a written account that she's, yes, written in a journal to her sister, basically. Yes. She's, but when you get to that point and you realize she's written that down to her sister, there become so fewer and fewer, like, no reasons actually for her not to have told her sister. Like, the person she's withholding the secret from is the person who knows the secret. You know what I mean? Because she's not telling the reader this story.
So it becomes more artificial.
She's writing this journal to her sister to explain her side of things, and yet the whole way she's withholding this thing that her sister knows about.
Yeah, because she was actually there.
She was – you know what I mean? Like, that withholding then just becomes like, what? What? What?
That's a good point.
It's like, it's
that
weird.
I hadn't thought of. No, that's a good point. Yeah.
Like, it's so weird because she's no – I mean, it was –
I mean, I picked early on that she's writing this to someone, or it must be the sister.
But well, it doesn't necessarily need to be a written down thing. Like, she's clearly talking to her sister. But and that's one thing. But to actually be writing a written record of it, and then in the writing of the written record not to write these things to someone who knows about these things. And they're not like – they're not an oblique – reference as though you're writing it to someone who already knows, so you don't need to explain it. They are definitely, when it's mentioned, it's definitely acts of withholding.
Yes, it's absolutely. Like, you're 100% right.
So,
and all this obscures the real strong aspect of the book, which is this idea about not only having the face of a murderer, but the blame the guilt, the blame, the ability to recover, you know, the scars that these sorts of things leave, her relationship with her father, you know, that. And again, I go back to this whole idea of not writing the book that I wanted.
But I wanted more about that
dynamic. And also the character who's in the book as Boots.
And Marcus. Yep.
That relationship as well. In the dream world, it's not that interesting because Boots is a...
I think because the dream world has so much... external pressure on the characters, because there are literally monsters there who are hunting the kids and killing them.
Yep.
And so there's so much external stuff about what's dangerous and what the issues are and what the conflict is and what they're running from. And it's all told from Lux's perspective
as well.
But the
turmoil that Marcus in the real world has gone through is given a throwaway end. Like,
yeah,
because the guy,
is.
I mean, there's this car that's following Alice at the very beginning of the story. We find out Marcus was in that car.
Yes.
And because Kel and Alice have swapped, Kel's gone into the real world, Alice into the dream world, Marcus literally kidnaps Alice,
and
Kel,
beats
the shit out of her.
Yes.
And all because he's guilty, that he thinks he's to blame for the reason why, and it's his sister. His sister gets shot too. His sister dies. So he's got all this fucking guilt.
Because he also blames himself Alice's sister also asked him to run away and they didn't run away. And so he's also blamed for the same thing. And this is what, like, psychologically, this is what doesn't get me. It's like, if she's got this, and she has a detailed plan. It's not an airy fairy plan to run away. Yeah. She has maps and printouts of how to survive, and she's put money, not a lot of money, but in her head enough money. And she's got all that, like, she has a really detailed, she's not like, some of these kids who don't detail plans to shoot people, a detailed plan to leave collector. Like, it's like some of these shootings in the US that happen, and when it comes out that these kids who did it had these enormously horrifically detailed plans of what they were going to do.
Of the shooting
and how they were going to do it.
Yeah.
And all of this sort of stuff, which it may or may not go to plan, but this is what they've been obsessing about for months, if not years. And it's just like that, it's just so awful. But that wasn't what Alice's sister was doing. Her plans and her focus and her obsession was about leaving Collector and getting the stuff to leave and planning to leave and who she's going to leave with and blah, blah, blah. And to suddenly, as you say, to suddenly flip that almost overnight and go, oh, well, I'll just shoot some people then. It's weird. It just didn't sit with me, because her plan wasn't – like, I also thought one of the reveals might have been that she told them and showed them a gun and said, I'm going to kill people, and they didn't believe her.
Yeah.
But no, what she showed them was all her stash that she was going to take leave.
And again, all this obscures the core of the book. Which is about that scars, the guilt, the grief.
Yeah, and
the inability to get away from your past because you look like a murderer in the skin of a monster. It's such a good premise. Oh, I just screamed.
And I think I agree with you. The shadow novel of this novel, where it is about Alice in the real world in Collector and how the town is treating her and how everyone is, as people do with the family members of people who carry out these acts, the family does get blamed a lot of the time in the media and in just in personal life. And now you have a family member who looks exactly like the person who killed everyone. Like, it's, you kind of ache for those people.
That's the book I wanted. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, maybe this is me. I've been very cynical. If you haven't noticed, maybe Catherine Barker sat there and thought, well, I just don't want to write what is basically a ripoff of Lionel Shriver's We Need to Speak About.
We need to talk about Kevin.
Yeah, we need to talk about Kevin because that does a lot of the same things.
Yeah, it does. And it's also told
if I don't add a fantastical element, it's just going to be compared to that book because it's going to be the only difference being that in this case, rather than be the mother talking about it, it's the
sister.
It's a sister. Because, in fact, even it's writing a journal to someone is the same, you know?
Yes.
Except the mother is writing to, I think, to the husband who got...
Yes.
Yeah, because we reviewed that on a previous episode of Ride of the Critic. And so let's add this fantastical element that makes it, that really breaks it away from that sort of comparison. It doesn't work. I just don't think it works.
I think
the shadow novel, I love that comparison.
It kind of ran away with it, I think, because, as you say, the kind of the meat of the book, which is about questions of culpability and guilt and misplaced guilt and just the big questions of why it happens and you know, what you can do to help it not happen.
Confronting the victims.
They're kind of pushed aside.
She and Mark, at the end of the book, go and confront the families of the victims. That's powerful.
Yeah.
But it's not treated in that way because all that confronting she's done in the dream world, because that's the whole thing with Lux, and she's now finding herself, her identity, whatever, which gives her the strength to go and do those things. Okay?
But that's almost an art. This is a book that has about four different endpoints. It's kind of like Lord of the Rings. There's another ending. There's another ending.
Yeah.
And you're right. And that the way that's done at the end where she ends up going and just talking and sometimes just sitting with the families of the victims and other people who are having tragedies in their lives. Because it has been 3 years. This hasn't just happened like last month.
No, but they are still tragic.
Yeah, but I'm just saying people are having other bad things in their lives that aren't related to the shooting. So she just goes and talks to them and becomes, I guess, kind of like a counselor. But that is treated so as like that's such an easy way. It wouldn't be easy. It wouldn't be easy. And it wouldn't fix things, not straight away. It's just treated like that's like a bit of a... Yeah,
I can't talk about this novel anymore.
Yeah. But, you know, there's stuff I really liked the idea, like the premise of it was really great.
I love the cover.
You love the cover. I will put that on the website. I love the idea of this alternate world. It reminded me a little bit actually of Only Forward by Michael Marshall Smith.
Oh, yes. Yeah, good one.
Yeah. So this alternate world, not that Alice or any of the characters have created this world. This world just exists.
I had no issue that the mechanics of that's not explained.
It maps onto the real world. And I like that when a tragedy happens, because it maps onto the real world, so that the part of this alternate world which is mapped onto this town where this thing happened becomes really dark and full of nightmares and monsters, because that is now what people are dreaming about and what they're thinking about.
The thing
about
is, I think there are two separate
about.
Books here.
Yeah, I just didn't feel that it didn't gel. It didn't gel together, and all the bits which I thought were really imaginative and interesting, were rather than sort of cohering and supporting each other, I felt they were kind of like wrestling with each other to get prominence in the book.
Beautifully said.
But I'm glad I read it. There was some really interesting.
Oh yeah, and I don't want people to think that I'm angry that I read this book. I think, again, when it's at its best, and there are moments when it's really strong. It has it has a sort of self-awareness to it, the writing, which is, and I was going to read out a quote, but I'm not going to bother now.
Yeah.
But just that, especially Alice, where she's constantly, you know, fighting against the cliche. It's that thing which authors do when they know there's this sort of vaguely cliched moment. So the character,
say it's a cliche.
Yeah, it's a cliche, you know, and that sort of constant, you know, not that, you know, this da 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 da, and it's just, oh God, stop being so self aware.
Because Alice's story, she is looking back on events from 3 years later. There is some perspective that she has there, but there's also some perspective that she should have that she doesn't have. Like, there's, I don't know, there's just, yeah, like you say, some of the retrospective sort of
it just set my teeth on edge. But I don't want you to I don't want you to think that I read it quickly. It's a good read.
It is a quick
sense.
Read, yeah.
And the whole withholding thing does make you turn the pages, even if the revelation is fucking.
And the chapters are all, like, another neat thing she does is just from a craft point of view is the chapters are all quite short. So you know, and they alternate religiously.
Alice Lux, Alice.
So
Lux,
you're never in Alice's or Lux's head for a long time.
Correct.
And some chapters are like literally two or three pages.
Yeah. It does have that annoying thing of,
so it does flip.
Alice says something at the end of a chapter, Lux picks it up at the beginning that Alice said.
Not always, though.
Yeah,
but get that interesting thing where you then get this perspective shift on the characters. So I like that.
At times it felt a bit like previously on the previous chapter.
Yes. So, it didn't always work. But I think she was for the most part doing that in quite a balanced way.
You keep trying to defend it.
Because there is a lot to like about it.
Yeah, I said it shouldn't have won, but I could see why it did. Because it is dealing with important issues. And it's saying something. I just think it gets obscured. Anyway, let's get on to the book.
Okay, so moving on. So that was, I'm going to back announce from now on. I know, so professional. So that was In the Skin of a Monster by Catherine Barker, which jointly won the Best YA novel for the Aurealis Awards, along with Day Boy by Trent Jemison.
Really, now that you're going to back announce, we need to have segue music.
No, we don't.
Yes.
So now we will move on
to. Can you find some segue music?
No.
All right.
We don't do. I don't do segue music.
Can I just hum something?
You're just annoying me now.
Yeah, basically. What's the next book, Kirsten?
You're running this show.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And the next one is the winner of – I love – these show notes are great. Winner of Best Children's Fiction, which is Meg McKinlay's A Single Stone. First off, what defines what best children fiction is? I mean, is this a middle grade – I mean, this whole middle grade young adult thing, is this aimed at 6 to 12-year-old sort of?
I would assume so. Because it's younger than young adult.
It's pretty mature.
Yeah. Yep. It's –
book that's dealing with
– to be honest, I would put it at no – lower a cognitive or maturity level than In the Skin of a Monster. And it's also a fairly, like, it's they say best children's fiction because that category can encompass illustrated books for children, like very short books with pictures. It can encompass, I guess, standalone short fiction that may have been published in an anthology or something like that. And it can also encompass, as we're looking at today, a short novel.
Yeah, because it's only about 50,000 words. But
yeah, but it is published as a novel with no pictures. But yeah, I guess the age
another striking cover
must have been pitched at I guess lower. But it is interesting because
it deals with forced abortions.
It's interesting because it was also it was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Award in the young adult category. And for the Adelaide Festival Awards for Literature, also in the young adult category. So it's, I guess, as much of a grey area, perhaps.
I want to say something controversial.
Yeah.
Okay. If this book had been entered into the young adult category.
Which it wasn't.
It wasn't nominated.
It was not submitted. It was only submitted into the children's
section. So it actually wasn't submitted.
Well, that's what I mean. It wasn't. No, if you look
at
the
The young adult judges didn't even. Okay.
No.
But if it had been. That's interesting in and of itself. But if it had been, I would have put that above Day Boy and...
I think I would have too.
It is a brilliant novel.
It's really, really good.
I'm pretty sure you said before we started this that you nearly cried at the end. I was fucking crying.
I did. I got those kind of tickly nose.
I lost
like,
it.
Oh.
And I didn't expect to. Halfway through the novel, I thought, this is good.
Yeah.
But that second half is a fucking barnstormer. I just love how it builds. It is a book that beautifully, gorgeously builds.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to cry now. It's brilliant.
It is such.
How high has my voice gotten?
It's gotten really high.
dogs
no,
are barking.
It's such a good book. It is odd. Like, I find it really odd. And I think possibly the publisher has done themselves a disservice by not entering it into the YA category as well as children's fiction. Because,
So you want to describe it?
Oh, look, I'll read the back, like, we did for the other one. Every girl dreams of being part of the line, the chosen seven who tunnel deep into the mountain to find the harvest. No work is more important. Gina is the leader of the line, strong, respected, reliable, and, as all girls must be, she is small. Her years of training have seen to that. It is not always easy, but it is the way of things, and so a girl must wrap her limbs, lie still, deny herself a second bowl of stew, or a first. But what happens when one tiny discovery makes Gina question everything she has ever known? What happens when moving a single stone changes everything?
And that is actually beautifully thematic of the novel, a small thing that occurs.
Yes.
In a sense, she gets her hands on a vial of a substance.
Yeah, well, it's a series of little things. Stones, that kind of put things together. But so basically, like, the setting of this is that there's this village.
It's a secondary world.
It's a secondary world, yeah. But so there's this village that – or there was this community that lived in the shadow of a mountain, and they mined the mountain for this stuff.
The men mined the mountain.
Well, yeah, because men were the miners, for this stuff called mica, which they used for, well, I guess all sorts of things back in the day, but for heating stuff, yeah, and making jewelry, and because it's flammable, but it will burn. It will just burn slowly as a cinder rather than go up in flames. Although it will go up in flames if you get a naked flame to it, but if you just spark it, it will just burn and give off light
at a regular consistent heat,
for quite a while until it, you know, burns itself out. And back in the day, like hundreds of years ago, the men delved too deeply and too greedily into the mountain, and there was like a collapse and
also a flooding.
Well, the thing is that it collapsed so badly that it caused huge environmental upheaval, and this village got trapped in this little valley, and they can't get out because there's impassable mountains all around them. So they're stuck in this tiny little valley and with this forest and not a lot of food and not a lot of ways to survive the winter when it snows and covers almost all of their houses. So they're reliant on this mica stuff to keep them warm over winter,
yes,
or they freeze to death. But there's this belief system which has built up over the years because of what's happened. So now men are not allowed near the mountain at all, and girls go in and they
– in fact, the matriarchy
matriarchal society, and they don't mine anymore per se. They kind of scrape the mica off the sides of the caverns and the alleys and stuff that go through the mountain, because they don't dig anymore. They don't move anything.
And the
mountain
is essentially a god to them.
The mountain is kind of a god, yeah, and bestows upon them the mica. But it's only the girls who go in because, you know, and there's always seven of them because it was seven women who came out of the mountain back when the disaster happened, who survived, who were buried but found their way out. So the idea is that the mountain only will allow women to come back out of itself. And so it's a really like, it's a fairly simple mythology, but quite complex in its own way. You know, there's a lot of you can see how this has happened.
Well, it's actually extremely complex because when you realize what they have to do to ensure that people can burrow through these very small holes.
Because they don't dig. This is the thing.
They do not dig.
They do not take tools. They do not chip away at the rock.
Correct.
They just have to go through the natural veins and channels and caves that has formed in the mountain.
Correct.
So the girls have
scrape
to be tiny.
Correct.
Yeah, so there's a ritual when a girl,
how angry were you?
Oh, it was so – like this book – like it is a secondary world book, but the – and this is a way that I think you can use fantastical elements to bolster your story.
Yes.
So this book is using a lot of the touchstones from our world in relations to eating disorders, in relation to various bodily practices.
Correct.
On young children, to whether it's binding feet or genital mutilation.
Not that this has genital mutilation.
No, it doesn't. But the phrases that are used, the things that happen, there's a
the thing is
you kind of lock into that.
This is a hermetically
this type of stuff.
But this is a hermetically sealed society, and this matriarchy
realizes
that if they're going to survive, they have to do these things in their minds.
Yeah. But – and what's so –
and like, what is it that they do? They take young – the first off, every child that's born, if it's a boy, it's a meh.
It's interesting because, like, the way they talk about the boy children, they're such a burden because you have to – and it's like
it's
the way that in some cultures the girl children are a burden because you have to provide dowry, and it's the boys who
are – when boys are born, people spit on the ground.
Yes, they don't. Boys are not. They're not. They're not killed. Like, boys aren't left out and exposed or anything.
No,
like
no,
that.
No. It's not. Not.
But
not,
it's just like, oh god, a boy.
And by the way, that's what I loved. Mm. It's not an overtly cruel society. The cruelty which exists is subtle and nuanced.
And what's so deeply, deeply troubling about it is that they're right.
Yes, that's what I was getting at.
You know, this is
the rationale
not a case,
to the cruelty. Yeah. It's not just, oh, we're just going to.
This is it's not a case of something that's done where if you don't do it, you know nothing will happen. It's just that it's culturally preferred for some reason. If they don't have small girls to go into the mountain and bring the mica out, they will die. Like, it's, yeah, it, like, that's what's so, and every time you kind of run up against it, it's just awful. So why are you doing it? Oh, because you'll die.
So let's go back. The girls that when they're born, so it's got to be girls, how many boys? But yeah. When girls are born, they check their circumference, their hip
of
size.
Their hips and their shoulders.
Their shoulders.
Yeah.
And the smaller, obviously, the better.
Yeah, so there's a ceremony where they, well, not a ceremony, I guess, that like a child's born and one of the mothers, and mothers with a capital M, because the elders of the village, the women elders, are just called the mothers.
Yep.
So one of the mothers will go in and measure the baby and come out and read out the measurements and hold the baby up. And the smaller the numbers, obviously, the better, because. Yeah. A small baby will grow into
and
a small
then what the,
girl.
What they do, and this is just taken as natural, is once those numbers are read out, they will then swaddle the baby.
Yeah,
but
bind them.
Bind them, essentially.
Really tightly.
To ensure that they don't develop naturally.
Yes, yeah.
Thicken.
Yes, because the girls can only go into the mountain, obviously, while they're still sort of pre-adolescent.
Yes.
Because as soon as they start to actually grow,
well, this binding
they're too
happens
big, and they
birth,
call that to the thickening.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I'm starting to thicken. I won't be able to go in the
mountain
anymore.
So imagine a society where the girls are
and they don't eat.
Regaled. They eat less, so they don't put on weight.
Yep.
And when they go
so
to sleep,
so skinny.
And so when they go to sleep, they are bound.
Yep.
They do it. They just do it. Yep. It's not like they've been forced. Yep. They do it.
Yeah.
And it's an honour to be in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
To barely
every girl
eat,
wants
to go hungry. Yep. And yes.
And this is why, like, so much of that language has come from, I don't know, but I would gamble a lot of money that McKinley has done a lot of research into anorexia and eating disorders, because so much of the language is directly from girls and women who have eating disorders and talk about the way they don't eat and measure things, and that it's just like it just mirrored perfectly that kind of language.
It's interesting when Leah is first introduced, Leah is a character that pops up, you know, very early in the novel, and you go, who's this? And then I'll be honest, I'm smart. I pretty much figured it out, but that actually works into the novel. But anyway, when she's introduced, it's interesting that she's eating.
Yes,
she's having a meal and she's enjoying the food, and it's a rabbit or
so
whatever.
So this is also a book
stew.
with two points of view.
Well, yeah, but one of them is really very short.
One's very short. So you've got Gina, who's and this is they're third person narratives in this book. So you've got Gina, who's your main character, and
she leads the line.
And
she's the girl.
Perfectly
that leads.
Done. It's her perspective. Yes. There is nothing she knows that she shouldn't know. There is nothing she
correct.
The reader is told that Gina doesn't know.
Correct.
And right. So it's beautifully done. And then you have interspersed sporadically throughout the book this other girl, Leah, who's
a bit of a tomboy.
Who's from
sorry.
Outside.
I know it's a terrible term, but
I know this is a beautiful thing. She's just a girl.
Yes.
Because she's from outside of the valley.
Except it's not clear that she – that's the thing about it. It's not entirely clear.
Oh, it's pretty clear.
You think it's – well,
she talks about her home and stuff.
That's
it's
right.
clear
yeah.
that she's not part of
true.
The village. She's she's an outsider. And you find out as the book goes along that she's from outside.
I suppose you could have guessed, well, hey, is this girl from 100 years before the cave-in or – you know, I mean, is
– oh, I guess you
is
could it, have,
is
yeah.
Is she contemporaneous with the action of the novel?
Yeah, it didn't.
That becomes much clearer. Obviously,
fairly soon.
Yeah,
too
correct. But it's interesting that she's introduced eating.
But McKinley does that. She does all of these very elegant, subtle little reversals of how Gina and her world is compared to how Leah is and her world. And because Leah's parts are so
especially
tiny.
Especially with the birds, the flying birds.
Yeah,
and
Leah's parts are so tiny, and yet she packs so much contrast into them in comparison to what Gina is like.
And she's a little scamp.
Like. She's a little scamp. So, yeah, it's a really interesting way to bring in a perspective, because you need Leah there, because at the point that where she comes into Gina's
– oh, it has to resonate. Otherwise, it's just someone who –
it can't just be – yes. Yeah. So – but she's done in a way – I think it's just so beautifully balanced. There's just enough of her that you don't forget she's there.
This is where
– but there's not so much of her that she becomes a separate story.
The withholding that Barker uses McKinlay doesn't do that.
No.
It's all out in the open.
It's all out in the open.
And you probably do figure it out pretty quickly
but
what's going on here.
But the beautiful thing with this
but that
book
thing
is,
it becomes the thing you wait for. You're not waiting for a revelation. You're waiting for a meeting.
Yeah, and the way so what we're going to say, and obviously we spoil books, people. This is such a beautiful book.
Seriously, stop listening and read this book and then come back.
So what the secret that Gina stumbles upon and then works out throughout the course of this book.
Herself
is what the mothers, mothers with a capital M, what the women elders in this village are doing now that has been done for at least a decade or two is they've actually started inducing pregnancies early at six, seven months. So
they're experimenting as to what's the best. It's somewhere between 6 and 7 months.
So the babies are born smaller. Babies are born premature.
They're premature
basically.
Babies.
And they're so small. I went and Googled images of 6-month-old babies. Like, oh my God, you should not be outside the womb. And
this is without humidity cribs.
This is the thing because like now our real world thing, 6 months is like the tipping point. Like that's just viable. So it's like, how many of these babies died young?
Oh yeah, you know? Yeah. That's implicit.
Because now with like,
because they're clearly experimenting on this.
Yes, but like we know now,
and I will say that this is eugenics.
6 months is like a tipping. Well, it's not eugenics.
It is eugenics.
Well, I guess it is because they don't induce every baby. They pick the babies who are from families where the mothers have gone into the mountain.
In a sense, it isn't because it's not trying to foster a trait over a genetic line.
Mm.
Although I suppose
they are doing it to families whose mothers and maybe grandmothers have come from the line.
Ah, yeah, true.
Right?
So there is an element.
So they know it's,
element
because
to
the thing
it.
Is they know it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. You don't like. I never really hated the mothers.
Oh, I did.
Because I did a little bit when I first. But then you go, because everyone will die.
No,
everyone
but I understand
die.
That. But
It's like they're not these evil caricatured villains, you know?
No, they're not.
It's done
I agree
so well.
Not,
and what I hated was the situation that, yeah, and it's like it's weird. It's like I didn't like them. I didn't go, oh, those poor women. But it was just horrible. But so they're inducing these babies early in the hopes that if they're born small, they'll stay small. And often that is the case. Babies who are born prematurely don't tend to be as physically large as children who are carried to term. Generalization, but it is often the case because, you know, we kind of need our 9 months in the womb to develop. That's how we're designed as animals. So if you get robbed of 2 or 3 months of that, you're going to have a bit of a rough start in life. And as you say, they don't have humidity cribs and, you know, intravenous feeding and heart monitors.
And I suppose one thing I was a little bit surprised at is there's not more because brain development happens in the last third.
Yeah.
And so that they're not more learning difficulties. I suppose, you know.
I think there's a hint of that actually.
Okay.
I think there is a hint of that because there is, I don't know, I'd have to read the book again and very carefully, but I'm sure I did remember some little asides about how some of the girls are not that bright. And I thought, I wonder if that's a brain development thing. But the wonderful thing about this book is that I got that immediately. There's this one reference, the first reference that it comes across is because Gina is talking to one of her friends who's the grandson of one of the head woman in the village.
Yeah.
And
her adopted mother is pregnant and
yes,
is about to have
yeah.
a child.
And the boy says, oh, and she had the baby and the boy makes a comment about how, oh, yeah, the mothers were so excited last night getting ready for the birth. And Gina thinks, oh, I didn't know it took that long or something. You know,
she'd been in labour overnight.
She goes, oh, but I guess they didn't tell us because we were on the line and we were tired. And as soon as that line was, I was like, oh, my God, they're fucking inducing.
Yeah.
But it didn't matter because you're not reading the story wondering what the secret is. You are reading the story waiting for Gina to find out.
And that can be annoying. That can be annoying when the reader knows. It's like watching a TV show when you know the murderer and then no one else does.
And they're
playing it as a tension thing. Like,
yes.
When will the true secret be revealed for everyone else?
Yes.
But here, obviously not playing that same game, but we figured it out. We both figured it out. But it's that it's seeing Jenna find that discovery, figuring out for herself. That's what's really interesting.
Yeah, it
and
is.
And then putting the two, one and one
the
together.
Pieces together. And because that's also not the, like, that's the big, that's the secret at the heart of the book, I guess, that Gina needs to work out. But that's not the end of the book. And that reveal doesn't finish the book, because once she works that out, then she has to decide what to do with that information.
No, but it's more than that. Figuring that out makes her put the figures together for what happened to her mother.
Oh, yeah.
About her father and why her what happened with her father. But, and, of course, that leads
but
to.
But what I'm saying is, like, working that out, that isn't like, and that's the end of the book. Oh, I've worked it out. No, because then, like, there's a significant more of the book left to go, because then she has to try and work out what to do about that information.
Stop.
Yeah.
I get annoyed with books.
Yeah.
And I've read one just recently, Updraft by Fran Wilde, where one person essentially topples an entire society by finding something out. Okay. Yeah. Because I think, oh, it just doesn't really work that way. I know, yes, there are great figures in history and that, but it really just doesn't.
It doesn't. No, it doesn't work that way. Because even the great figures in history had their teams.
Correct. Correct. You know. And yet this book is that.
But
a girl.
It's not.
Discovers a secret that more or less topples a society.
But it doesn't. And that's the beautiful thing, because that's what I was so worried about this book. Like, I'm getting near the end. It's like, oh God, don't do this. Don't make her go, and here's the truth. And everyone goes, yay. Because that's not what happens.
No, that's not what happens.
First of all, she decides she's going to go tell everyone, and she goes and finds those books that would be proof of what's happening, of the mothers inducing the babies. And then the mothers are kind of chasing her and saying, you can't. And then at the very end, she decides, she can't. She can't tell them. It's not her place to tell them. It's like, ballsy fucking move on behalf of the author to recognize that this young girl recognizes that may not be enough. You know, and so she's just going to leave. And it's like, That's she's not going to take on this massive thing. She's just going to leave.
Yes.
Which it just read so perfect. And it was like, no, you need to go back and tell them. But at the same way, it was like, it made perfect sense, because it's huge, and it's just so much. It's so much for her to have to do. And she's just like, fuck it, I'm out of here. Because, you know, like, who's going to believe her over the mothers, she thinks, and the books have kind of gotten wet in the
rain.
Well,
she hopes that Liar's existence, because she comes across
Leah.
Leah's existence will also be, because obviously this is a hermetically sealed place.
Yeah.
There are no strangers to this town, and everyone knows everyone. Leah accidentally destroys all the mica at the end of the book and then turns up.
But she doesn't know about that before she goes back to the mountain.
Who? Oh, she doesn't know about Leah.
Right?
Yeah, you know.
So her decision to just find where her father went all those years
correct.
Ago.
She's figured out that her father went in that direction for a reason.
Yeah.
And so.
And she's going to find the way through the mountain, and she's just going to
leave. And she has guilt as well that she let go of her sister's hand, and that caused her sister to die.
Yeah, because her sister was a baby and there was a bit of an earth thing.
So you're right. Yeah. She goes, I can't be just me. I can't do it.
I can't do it. And she's just going to go. So her decision is just to go, to have faith that there is another world out there, that her father is beyond the mountain, and she will find a way. And that's her decision. And it's a perfectly acceptable decision. But you read, it's like, no, you must go back. You must tell everyone. You must rouse the village. And it's amazing. Like, it's just so good how this book does it.
So when Leah does turn up.
When Leah does turn up.
It's just even stronger.
Yeah. And also because it doesn't happen like that. It's not that Leah comes and everyone goes, oh, my God, amazing. No, most of the village stays behind.
Yes, they do.
They don't immediately break up the village and set off
across
the mountain.
There's comedy in a novel that she thinks that people will eventually leave.
Eventually, but it's not like the whole village just goes, oh, well, gee, we were wrong. No, people are scared. They've got this massive belief system built upon the past and the mountain and what happened, and no, we can't go through the mountain will reject us. And so most of the village does not go with her and Leah and the boy whose name slips my mind at the moment. So a small little band of young people decide to go off and go with Leah back to where, and find a way back to where she came from, because there's been a bit of a lapse again, and so it's not just an easy, oh, we'll just go the way Leah came. They actually have to now find another way. But that's it. It's this small group who've decided to leave everything they know and everything they've been told and everything they've grown up with and their whole belief system, because they've gotten evidence, clear is evidence, that there is another way and a better way. It's to like, it's just wonderful because the book had ended with the whole village packing up and said it would have been like, oh, for fuck's sake. But it's not, because that's not what happens. So it's great that the bulk of the village is there. And yes, hopefully a pass will be opened and there will be cultural exchange, and it's, and these people won't be stuck in this horrendous little valley.
She thinks that ultimately that, you know, they'll create their own place on the other side of the mountain.
Yeah. But that also the people back in the village might.
Yeah, that's it. You know, no, they will. Yeah. So.
So, yeah, it was just so beautifully handled and so well balanced, and it really didn't flinch. Like, it was a book that didn't, like, it wasn't graphic in any way, and you had characters who died.
Yes.
Not just the babies, but you had characters who died, so there was real,
it's not gratuitous,
bad great. Things that happened in this book, but it was really elegantly done.
Yeah, it's beautifully done. I do have one question.
Yeah.
So matriarchies.
Yes.
didn't you know, how feminist is this book? I know it's an odd question to ask.
Yeah.
I know that.
Are you equating feminism with the matriarchy?
Well, no.
Because I think this book's very feminist, because this book is all about choices and not forcing other people into a choice that you make.
But the fact that we might have to cut this part of the podcast because I might make an ass of myself, but the fact that a group of women have constrained the choices of other women and men, how does that come off?
Not good. But this is I think if you have any society,
yeah, no, I think
where one gender is ascendant,
I think the,
and you have belief systems that revolve around, for whatever reason, the superiority of one gender over another, you have an unbalanced society which does not work for everybody. So the fact that it's a matriarchy doesn't matter. It's not going to be a good society. Feminists don't want a matriarchy. Some might. We're not all the same. But, you know, a lot of feminists, they don't want a matriarchy. They don't want to overturn the patriarchy and put in a matriarchy.
I just think of those I am in uncharted waters here, okay? All right, right now. So I'm making an ass of myself.
No, it's fine.
I think of those Star Trek episodes that they used to do, where you'd have Planet of the Women.
Yeah.
I think of one in particular. From season one of Next Generation, Planet of the Women, and where the men are the second-class citizens as well.
Yeah.
And in fact, the whole purpose of the episode was to show, see, women can't run things because they fuck it up as well, and they're as evil, and da-da-da-da-da, and therefore – and they were anti-feminist screeds because they were all about the Planet of the Women. Yeah. This is Society of the Women, because although, to be fair, men aren't classed as second-class citizens.
Yeah, I was about to say
– having said that, spitting when a boy is born
– you don't spit on the child, though.
No.
It's like the old – it's like a superstition thing. It's like
– yeah,
because that's also maps to our world, but where you spit to ward off bad luck.
Men aren't second-class citizens.
No.
So
and I think that – and that is the difference between – so I think what this book does, it sits very carefully and very thoughtfully in this middle ground where it is happy to critique a culture that has arisen out of a superstition. Right? Because really there would be no reason why a young skinny boy can't go into the mountain.
Well, it's proven. A young skinny boy does go through the mountain.
Exactly. The superstition. So the boys could join the line and harvest mica. I mean, the thing is not to drill into the rock anymore, right?
Yeah, but
the superstition comes from.
Men are limited in this society.
And this is what I'm saying.
There's a glass ceiling. Rock ceiling, you know.
But this is what I'm saying, right? So a lot of, like, some of the reasons why the girls are preferred is based on superstition and a particular interpretation of what has actually happened and how the world works.
Yes.
And the fact that this particular society, you know, and the fact that it had flipped from a society where the men did all the mining, and that's why men aren't on the mountain anymore, because they made it angry, is really interesting. So it's sitting there and it's I think it is critiquing a culture where one gender is valued more highly for partly arbitrary reasons, or not arbitrary, but not evidence-based, or, you know, superstitious reasons. And pointing out that that's not good either. Just because it's run by women, that's not going to be a good society.
I know.
I
wasn't critiquing the book. I just want to point out.
Unlike some of those Star Trek episodes where you, and their ilk that you mentioned, they're not doing it just because they think women are better. It's based on the fact that they need to go into the mountain and they need to do this and they need to make smaller children and blah, that's all, as we were talking before, it actually kind of needs to happen in a very real life and death situation.
I raised that because I wanted to point out that the book is nuanced. Yeah. That's the point.
So the women aren't sitting there going, oh, women are better than men and men are pigs and we will keep them enslaved.
Well, no, but there is an element of that women are better than men in terms of dealing with the mountain. Men cannot be trusted.
Absolutely.
Women can be trusted. Yes. Women survive the fall. Women can be trusted, and it's an honour to do that job.
Yes, absolutely.
So there is an element.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that then men are, well, the boys are left out to be exposed, little boy children, and that men have got no purpose. And
no, that's right.
I mean, we don't know how the actual governance of this place works, but the mothers are rule.
Yeah, they are. But no, I mean, little boy children aren't left. I mean, there's like one of the families there has five boys and they've had a girl and it's amazing because she can, the girls who work the line in the mountain get more an allocation of this mica over. Because the more important you are in the village, the more of this stuff you get.
Which is why having five boys is a bit of an issue.
It's bad because you've got all those mouths to feed and you're not going to get as much mica over winter to see you through. But, you know, none of those boys have been killed.
No. Well,
they haven't been exposed. Like, the society
has. Because I think the mothers figured out you need boys to have babies.
You don't need a lot. You certainly don't need five.
And you could just.
But this is what I mean. Yeah. So it hasn't gone to the. She hasn't created this world to the extent where the men really are second class citizens and little boy babies are just left to the elements.
Yeah. And that's the nuance, you know, that I'm talking about.
So it's not this evil matriarchy where men are horrible and it is much more nuanced than that. But it is still critiquing this kind of superstition and critiquing a culture that is dominated by one gender for no good reason. Really. And I think that's fantastic because it's true. You cannot have a world where a segment of the population is deemed to be better than the rest.
Correct.
And have a society that functions for everybody and is fair for everybody. So I wouldn't have liked this book as much if it had gone down, the women are all wonderful and the men are not.
So on that point.
So it does. It treads this lovely balance, and I think it's, and in answer to your original question, I think yes, it is absolutely a feminist book because it is about
the choices,
and it is also a really, as you say, a nuanced discussion of other choices that get made for the quote unquote greater good,
and the
repercussions.
Because
of
let's
those
be honest,
choices.
if they knock down a hole in the mountain to get out, your options are you keep doing what you're doing because. Frankly, that's the only way you can survive, or you just all die out and you go, well, that we can't cope with the truth of what we're doing.
Or you start carefully digging in the mountain again. You break down your belief system and say, look, we can't gather the mica anymore from the surface. We're going to have to find a way to start digging
again. We have to engineer
again.
This, yeah.
Right? So there is another option, but that does involve a breaking down of your centuries-old belief system. Right? So the book is about all of that,
and it is
really interesting. And no one really is. That's, I think that was the most astonishing thing about it. It would have been so easy to make one of the mothers, especially I guess the head woman, to be a really villainous person.
And she isn't. And there's
and
this
no
beautiful
one's
bit.
A villain.
There's this beautiful bit, and it's only very short, but there's a beautiful bit where Jenna thinks about it, what those mothers did for her. You know, they looked after her when she was sick.
That's
they fed her. They taught her. She loves them. She loves them.
Yeah.
And they love her.
Yeah.
But
they do love
her. The truth sucks.
Yeah. Like it's such a complex book.
Please.
And
please.
I loved it so much.
I hope if you've listened this far, you've actually read the book.
Yeah. But if you haven't, look, I mean.
No, but you haven't. Yeah. Look, just.
Like I said, I think an astute, mature reader. Maybe if you're a 10-year-old, you're not going to start be thinking about inducting births.
Yeah.
But I think an astute adult reader is going to pick up on all of the things that Gina doesn't know. And I'm not going to call them reveals because they're not structured that way in the book.
Yep.
The book's not building to a reveal.
She's a 14-year-old girl. I mean, inducing births is not something that's going to pop in
your head.
It's
stuff Gina doesn't really know. And the fact that a lot of the time you as a mature reader – do put pieces together and go, oh, that's not good, doesn't spoil the book because the book itself is not treating that information as though it's something that it needs to withhold from the reader. The book doesn't care if you know because the book is about Gina.
That's right. I agree.
And it works beautifully.
I will do my high-pitched voice again to say how fucking much I love this book.
Yes.
And thank you, Aurealis Award judges, for awarding it because I wouldn't have.
I wouldn't have even come across my radar. I don't think so.
Once again,
a big thank you too to Deb Kalin, because not being across children's fiction, not having children or young children in my life anymore, because all of my nieces and cousins and that are all grown. I don't think I even would have looked at the children's fiction list anyway.
Because we could have chosen best science fiction if we wanted to.
But Deb Kalin, who was also at Contact where the Aurealis Awards were announced, came up to me the next day or something and said, "Have you seen that book that won best children's fiction?" And I went, "No." She goes, "It looks amazing. I've just bought a copy." And I went and looked at it. It's like, oh, my God, it looks amazing.
And you know what? It was.
It was amazing. So, yes. So, you know, in this respect, I guess we could say the awards have had a very concrete effect.
Correct.
Like, she sold at least two more copies of this book to you and me, and hopefully some of our listeners may go out and buy some.
Well, they should.
Honestly, it is such a good book.
Okay, so we have to wrap up.
We do have to wrap up.
Because I have to travel 130 kilometres in the other direction.
For God's sake. Cry River. I used to do this every month on the train.
On the comfort of a train. I have to put my foot on an accelerator.
Yeah, you get there in half the time.
That's a good point. Now, a couple of things. First off.
Yes.
Next episode, we'll be doing authors of significance or well-regarded authors who neither of us have read.
For some reason, we just haven't read them. And we've been meaning to for years.
And when you hear who it is, you'll go, really?
You will hang your heads. Well, we will hang our heads in shame and you will go, tut, tut, tut.
But obviously, we're fixing it. So the first one is Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler, and I believe we have to thank Ben Peake for
Peake for a recommendation for if you've never read any Octavia Butler novels before, what would be the first one you would recommend? And he said, "Oh, that's a good one." Okay, so we're going to do that.
That's an okay one. And we said, "All right, fine." And the second one is The Fifth Child by Doris Lessing.
Yes,
I can't actually believe I haven't read The Fifth Child by Doris Lessing.
No, I'm pretty sure I've read at least one or two pieces of short fiction by both those authors, but I have never read any novels by them. And I don't know why. They're like two authors who I've known of for many, 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 many years, have always kind of meant to read and just haven't. I think I've even got a copy of Kindred on my bookshelf, which is Octavia Butler's book.
I definitely
own. But haven't even
no, I own at least three books I know in my garage. I think I own Parable of the Sower.
So it's so we are rectifying a large lacuna our reading life.
You used the word lacuna twice in this podcast.
I like that one.
I know you do. thank you to our new patrons. We have two new ones.
Oh, and that was my friend Michelle who was raving about the Doris Lessing book. So
Michelle, who I believe is just sending us tweets as we speak on this as the podcast goes.
Is she?
Because I tweeted when you went off to check the computer.
Not that Michelle.
Not that Michelle's
no,
another Michelle.
Another Michelle.
How many Michelles do you know?
I know a few Michelles.
Wow, this podcast. Now, you're sure that's the amount of patrons we picked up?
Yes.
All right. So thank you to our new patrons, Chris and Emily.
Yep. So exciting.
And of course, you know what that means.
What does that mean?
More money for me.
Oh,
we're not going to get another cent. That Mond, so greedy. Anyway, and on that note.
Yes.
I'm glad I wrote because I'd forgotten.
Yes.
So we're coming to the Patreon vote nominates.
We are.
In August, we are going to read the Patreon choice book.
Yes.
Or books.
Patron's choice.
It's two books.
Oh, it'll be two books.
Two books. So, Kirsten, can you explain how we're going to do this?
Because okay. What will happen is, or by the time you're listening to this, it will have happened. It will be happening. I'm going to put a post up on the Patreon website, which will be a patrons only post. And basically, if you are of the patron level of $3 a month or higher, you can reply onto that post with the book you would like us to talk about in August. We'll probably leave the nominating open up until the end of May or possibly the first week of June, but I'll say that in the post. And I will make a list of all the books that people have nominated. And the only ones I'm going to remove are ones that Ian and I have already read because we would like to read a new book.
Yes, we would.
So if you've already read them, I won't include them in the nomination list. But other than that, basically any book you guys wish to nominate will make the list.
Well, that's the question. Now, here's the question.
Mm-hmm.
What's a patron's choice? Because don't we have a reward that people like actually choose which book?
I'm getting there.
Oh, you're getting there. Gotcha.
You've just jumped the gun.
Sorry.
There's the gun. You jumped it. So once I have the nomination list from all of our $3 a month and above patrons, I will go back onto the site at the beginning of June and I will do another post with that list of titles that our patrons have nominated.
Now, who gets to vote, though?
Patrons at the level of $2 a month get to vote on the list of nominated books. Oh, so yeah, everyone who's nominated obviously can vote as well. But yeah, people who are also one level below them. So there'll be more people voting than there are nominating, which will be nice because that will broaden the pool of influence, I guess, over the ultimate patron's choice.
Yeah. All right. So that's what we're going
to
do with that.
And by the time you're listening to this, that will be up and you'll be able to go and nominate your books. We do ask, I think, that every patron only nominates up to 2 books.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So don't give us like a whole list of 10 books you'd like us to talk about. Just pick 2 books that you would like,
and they can
or
be,
one if you don't want
there's
to
There's no limit on when they were published? Or
no limit. We would prefer if they were spec fic-ish. Don't go recommending Great Expectations, people, because I've read it apart from anything else.
Bleak House, yes, though.
Go that ahead. Is super long.
All right. Yes.
And the only other thing I would ask is if you're going to recommend parts of trilogies/series, it'd be really good if they kind of stood alone as a book, just in case we
or
haven't
book
read them.
One.
Or book one of, sure. Book one of is always a good choice. So that's how that will work. Go and nominate the books you'd like us to talk about. And then in June, you guys can then select the books. That's exciting.
And if we're lucky, the sad puppies might get in. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, don't say it. You say them aloud and they come.
Okay,
they've got
so,
supersonic hearing like dogs.
Yeah, I know. Please send feedback by commenting at the website. writerandcritic.podbean.com. Send an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, writerandcritic, which, as I said, while you were running off to check the computer,
yes,
which won't actually be on the podcast because you paused the recording,
pause it.
I tweeted that we were literally podcasting right now. And I think I've had a couple of likes on that.
Oh,
so
nice.
There you go. So there you go. I tweet during the podcast.
You can also comment on our Patreon website too if you are a patron.
Yes, which we noticed. And, of course, sponsor us on Patreon so you can be part of the whole voting.
If you can.
Nomination experience.
This podcast will still remain free for everybody, regardless
Everyone.
Of whether you are a patron or not.
Correct. Absolutely. We are free for all.
That's not what I said.
No. Bye, everyone.
See you next month.
See you. Bye.
Bye. Hi, guys. Ian's just left, and this is the first time I've had all my recording gear here to myself for a very long time. It has been living with Ian for the past 3 years. So, because I know he never listens back to these recordings and I can really do anything I want to them, though I don't because I am a good person, this is just a message from me to you guys. I love you all. Thank you so much for listening to us over the years and for the emails we get and the feedback. And of course, for those of you who've been able to sponsor us on Patreon, we really, really appreciate it. All of you listeners, patrons, you bring joy to our lives. Thank you so much. And now let's play a game. As you know, Ian's the one who's usually on our Twitter account. So how about you guys spend the rest of the month tweeting random words at Ian? Words you love, words you hate, words you've just come across, dictionary.com's word of the day, your favourite words, words with really interesting definitions, words that have fallen out of favour, words that you wish would come back. No explanation, no reason, just tweet them at him. He'll love it, I promise, and he'll never know why. Here's my word of the month, onomatopoeia, a word which sounds like what it is, which is in fact the definition of onomatopoeia. Love you guys. Bye.